I'm opening the meeting of the House Education Committee for Monday, May 21st. And first thing we're going to do is open an informational hearing on the response and procedural practices in handling educator complaints. So, and we have Dr. Anthony Roselli on the phone, and then Trent Danowski is also here from TSPC. So I don't know.
Thank you. While Trent is getting set up, this is Anthony Roselli, Executive Director of TSPC. Chair Doherty, Vice Chairs Wilson and Hernandez, thank you for giving us this opportunity to present in front of the committee. As you have requested, we will be speaking to you briefly on the disciplinary practices that we follow. TSPC, within its three charges, which are licensure, program approval and development, and then the third being professional practices, will be the topic of today's conversation. Professional practices, as I have mentioned in a previous meeting, from the TSPC perspective, is a licensure process in a way. And many times when you have disciplinary matters that come before the commission, it may be a period of time before that's happened, because the lengthy process that Mr. Danowski will review in a minute. But I do want to remind the committee and anybody who is wanting to understand more about the process being used for professional practices is that TSPC is a licensing agency, and many of the activities which people are often concerned about regarding abuse or other gross negligence of duty are actually fall within what we would call employment matters. So I think that that'll become clear as Mr. Danowski continues with the presentation. And as I mentioned to Alicia, that I will probably be out of range in the next 20 minutes, so I just wanted to apologize for that. But Trent is more than capable and has everything he needs to present. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Dr. Roselli before we leave, before he gets out of range? Okay, we don't see any. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Trent?
Yes. Good afternoon, Chair Doherty, Vice Chairs Hernandez and Wilson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Trent Danowski. I am Deputy Director of the Oregon Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And in echoing Dr. Roselli's, I wanted to thank all of you for inviting us to present today. So we have been, as Dr. Roselli said, we were requested to present on the complaint and investigation process with TSPC, and I understand we have a condensed time frame, so I will move rather quickly through the slides, and certainly members of the committee can slow me down as needed. Legal mandates and responsibilities. TSPC is required by state law to investigate any and all complaints that may constitute grounds for discipline, and likewise within our administrative rules. District administrators and school level administrators are required, when they have reasonable belief that a violation has taken place, to report that educator, that licensed educator, to TSPC. Before we get too far into the presentation, just I felt it necessary to at least point out that the manner in which TSPC can respond to complaints is constantly shifting based on court rulings. And I've listed three that have become or have the potential to be, relatively significant. The Burgesson and Eakes case have significant impact in the manner in which TSPC can proceed with a complaint for a variety of reasons. And then the Lockett case, which is a recent ruling, has impact in terms of how TSPC must navigate post-commission or the appeals process, basically, for cases in which we sanction upon. So mediums through which TSPC receives complaints and opens investigations. Our formal complaints come from two primary sources, the school districts and from members of the public or patrons. And both of those complaints are opened through our website, and I will be showing that in just a moment. But we also receive information from other mediums that could lead to open TSPC investigations. Those include DHS cross-reporting. Those include media and news reports, and also internal referrals from within TSPC. For example, if there's a licensure issue, we would refer internally and open an investigation in that matter. So as I mentioned, formal complaints, which by law we must investigate, come from the school districts and from public complainants, and those are initiated through completion of a one-page form, which is found on our website. Both the school districts and the patron complaint forms are accompanied by a guidance form, as I said, the complaint forms are one page apiece, with the option for both districts and patrons to add attachments of up to 3 pages of additional information as they see fit. And all complaints are sent through a single TSPC email address. So this is just a visual of one of the guidance forms, the school district misconduct reporting guide. And then this is, again, a visual of the school district misconduct report form. So we often are asked, when should school districts report to TSPC, under what circumstances? And in response to that, we have presented this particular slide many times over. Under administrative rule, chief administrators within a district or school are required to report to TSPC executive director within 30 days of the time when the chief administrator reasonably believes that a gross neglect of duty or gross misconduct, in other words, a violation of rules, has taken place. This rule includes licensed educators who may not be employed within the district from which the complaint originates. And we find it very important that, in terms of that 30 days, we find that 30 days important because it provides districts with an opportunity to complete at least a preliminary investigation of their own to establish that reasonable belief that a violation has occurred. And we hope that that 30 days will allow the district to substantiate some things and not file a complaint with us, which may not need to be filed in the first place. So once a complaint is received by TSPC, it is assigned to one of our investigators. TSPC employs 4 investigators within the professional practices unit. 3 of those positions are permanent, and we do have 1 limited duration investigator. I think it's of note that 3 of the 4 TSPC investigators have completed the National Certified Investigator and Inspector Training, or NCIT, and hold national certificates as investigators. And we hope to have the 4th investigator go through that training as soon as possible. So once the case is assigned to the investigator, it is one of the duties of our investigators to assign a priority to that case based on the nature of the violation being reported. And this slide outlines the case priority determination that every case goes through. And of course, at the top is student safety, which is the sexual abuse, the boundary issues, and the assault complaints which come before TSPC. Those are prioritized at the top of every investigator's caseload. Below that, drugs and alcohol, failure to report, so on and so forth. While working on priority cases, it is possible for investigators to quote-unquote squeeze in a simpler or less priority case as part of their investigative process. An investigator can probably work actively on about 4 to 5 cases at a time as they're working through their cases. Delays with other venues do exist. Many of our top priority cases have other agency interests which need to be resolved prior to TSPC taking action. So the sexual abuse, the boundaries issues, the assault cases, a lot of them are also being investigated by law enforcement, for example, or perhaps they're pending court determinations, criminal court or otherwise. In those instances, TSPC will actually delay our investigation and wait for those other venues to conclude before we press forward with the investigation and determination in that case. So this is a snapshot of a recent snapshot of TSPC caseload in terms of priority cases. In the first graphic, the one on the top left, percentage of top three priority cases, you will note that under 30% of TSPC cases at this time fall into those top three categories of sexual assault or abuse, assault, or grooming behavior. The remaining 63% are outside of those categories. When we look at the case priority cases based on the priority system, which was laid out in the previous slide, we see that 48% of current TSPC cases are now currently categorized as non-priority, meaning the other 50% would jump those cases in terms of the investigator prioritizing those cases. Excuse me. So what's included within a TSPC investigation? No two investigations are exactly the same, so I did put the word typical in quotes. But a typical TSPC investigation may include all of the following: subpoena of the school district, collecting documents from patrons who filed the complaint, obtaining copies of law enforcement or DHS reports, conducting interviews of the educator under investigation, and interviews of any witnesses. So once the investigation is concluded, the investigator has concluded their investigation, a final summary report is written up and it is submitted to me for recommendation to the commission. As the designee in charge of this, I make a recommendation, and that recommendation consists of whether or not a sanction is warranted and what that sanction might look like. And what I provide to the commission is only recommendation information. The commission makes all final decisions on what the sanction would be if there is one. Commission factors for imposing discipline. I'm not going to read this verbatim. There's a lot of information there, but some of the factors to note: educators' past performance, pattern of behavior is something that can be taken into consideration with the commission in terms of sanctioning. Extent, severity, and imminence of danger to students, other educators, public, etc. So there are a variety of considerations when sanctioning. So in instances where the commission chooses to sanction an educator's professional license, all educators have due process rights that must be followed through and completed before the commission can finalize the sanction. And this is, believe it or not, a very much simplified slide of what that due process looks like. This is very much just hitting the high points. So once the commission chooses to sanction, the educator is sent a letter, a notice of hearing letter, and has 21 days to respond. If the educator does not respond in 21 days, the commission can issue a default order, and it's over. The order is final. If the educator chooses requests a hearing, the process continues. TSPC can negotiate a settlement prior to hearing. We have a legal liaison employed whose full position is purposed with actively trying to settle cases before going to hearing and moving the process forward in that regard. Cases can also be referred to the Office of Administrative Hearings by our DOJ. All actions, whether it be the settlement through internal processes at the agency level or the case going through a full hearing, all of those decisions are reviewed and, have to be reviewed and approved by the commission before they can become final. And order becomes final, and when that order becomes final, that's when TSPC can publicly post that decision on our website and make that information public upon request through a public records request or something like that. A few notes on our timelines and confidentiality of TSPC materials. Since November of 2016, and I chose that date because that was the start of my tenure at the agency. Since the November of 2016, the average length of a TSPC investigation is 8.7 months. And when I say TSPC investigation, what I am referring to is from the date the complaint was received by TSPC to the date the investigator submits the complaint of a submits the completed investigation to the executive director or designee. 30% of TSPC investigations are completed currently in 6 months or less. Numerous factors beyond our control can extend the amount of time a TSPC investigation lasts. Some of these factors are responsiveness of the educator's attorney, or the employing school district to TSPC requests for information and interviews. Actions pending in other agencies, criminal investigations, and civil courts can also extend the amount of time an investigation lasts. And high caseloads for our investigators also have an impact on that. Is there a question?
We're going to wait till questions at the end. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Okay. As I'm sure everybody's aware of, state statute maintains the confidentiality of all TSPC investigations materials unless and until the commission makes a final determination to charge the educator. The final determinations, the final orders are the signifier that the investigation is complete and the information can become public. The commission cannot approve a final order until the educator has had the opportunity to complete the appeals or due process. And as a commission, as an agency, we have very little control over how long the appeals process may take. So that is part of the consideration. This information is not presented in an effort to change the ORS, rather to illustrate that the public perception that a TSPC investigation takes, quote, years, is, in my opinion, somewhat flawed. This perception is based solely upon consideration of the time span between when TSPC receives the complaint to when it is legally allowed to post the information publicly. This is an inaccurate conclusion since the educator's completion of the appeals process is also a significant determining factor as to when TSPC can publicly and legally post information results, so on and so forth. Wrapping up here, I just wanted to share some a brief snapshot of data with the committee. On the screen, 5 years worth of data in terms of investigations considered by the commission, the number of those investigations that led to charges by the commission, and the number of investigations that were ultimately dismissed by the commission. Of note, or you might note in the far right of that top graph, that over 50% of TSPC investigations result in dismissal or no further action. And that's been a consistent pattern for not only the 5 years that I have illustrated here, but beyond that as well. Also, just for information purposes, the chart below that, new complaints received for investigation by year. 2017, we did receive 254 new complaints for that year alone, which is up from 2016, but certainly not the highest we've ever seen either. So, with that, I hope that was rather expedient, and I will wait for questions.
Okay, you have any questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you. I've got a couple, so with the chair's indulgence. So looking at your chart and the numbers that you just had and mirroring them to a screen that's a few screens up where you have your pie graph, based on your numbers, your sex abuse cases at 8.73% against the amount of cases that you have seem to average in the last 3 years between 23 and 29 cases of sex abuse, if your numbers are right and my math is right. So a couple things around that. Does TSPC's complaint timeline that you just outlined, it could take it 8 months or whatever, is there a faster path for sex abuse? Do you have an automatic suspension if there are charges actually brought by law enforcement, or does TSPC actually go through their own process even if the courts are moving faster than your process?
Right. So with these priority cases, with sex abuse cases specifically, It should be noted that that there are mandatory revocation laws in place, and an educator who is criminally convicted under any of those laws, and I have it noted in here which where that can be found, but an educator criminally convicted of those laws is by law required to have a TSPC is required to revoke their license. So if the and I should also note that TSPC will wait for those criminal cases to conclude before we follow through on our case, because the DHS, the law enforcement, those criminal investigations produce, in general, generally speaking, far more information for the commission than we could do on our own, and it is it just strengthens our TSPC case to wait for those to conclude. If it is a case of mandatory revocation, that's what it is. It goes to the commission as a mandatory revoke, and that's the commission's decision. Are there other avenues to expedite those cases? It is always a fine balance. It is something that I struggle with quite a bit. I did show you this graphic here where we still have over 50% dismissal rate as well. So it's that fine balance of investigating the educator, investigating these very serious charges, no doubt about that, but also ensuring that at the end of our investigation we get it right, because we do have very high stakes with these investigations, not only for the students, and I'm not downplaying the student safety aspect of this, but it's high stakes for the educator as well. I would also point out that the districts are really the front line in defense of those types of things. TSPC does not have the authority to pull an educator from the classroom when we start an investigation. The districts have the authority to do that. Right now, we don't have the authority to say this educator is under investigation, so pull them from the classroom. It's not in our jurisdiction to do that.
Follow up?
Yes.
There's a couple just missing data points for me on your slide. I appreciate that you took the time to compile it. I would be interested in subsequently having an understanding of how many of these cases were sex abuse cases in your investigations and your complaints received, how many of them resulted in a revocation of licensure or some sort of, you know, other sanction, or how many of them were dismissed. I think that it would be interesting to know for the committee, given that we continue to sort of see these headlines in the press. The other piece of this is do you do sort of a lateral tracking? So, you know, Sally teacher has a complaint, you've dismissed the complaint, and next year Sally teacher has a complaint again. How much kind of longitudinal tracking are you doing of teachers in the TSPC system who have multiple complaints?
Yes, thank you for the question. We do track that information, and that information does appear before the commission if an educator has had multiple complaints that have come before TSPC previously, and that the commissioners receive basically a summary of the previous cases and the results of those cases. Now, that is not always public information, because if the previous investigations through TSPC were dismissed by state law, that information becomes confidential. So that's not always something that we can release publicly. But yes, commissioners are aware of if a specific educator has been investigated by TSPC before.
But it's not applied to subsequent disciplinary process. If you've dismissed it and somebody has a track record of multiple TSPC complaints that have been dismissed, you're not using that at all in sort of the lens of the current complaint.
I apologize, I misspoke. Let me clarify my previous statement. Yes, patterns of behavior can be considered by the commission. So if those previous investigations by TSPC were related to the one that's currently before them, they can absolutely consider those previous investigations as part of their actions.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Wisner?
No.
Okay, anybody else?
Sure.
Representative Springer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed between the years 2014 and 2015, complaints more than doubled. Did you go online that year? What would account for that big spike?
So So I'm sorry, are we talking about the lower graph or the upper graph?
The upper graph. It says 2014, 141 investigations considered.
Right, right.
And maybe I'm missing something here, but I'm just seeing a huge spike.
Correct,
right there.
Correct. So investigations considered, thank you for the question, Representative Springer. Investigations considered is the key phrase there. Between 2014 and 2015 is the, and I don't have the exact date, but that is the general time frame in which the agency was approved for an additional limited duration investigator, and we were able to add additional staffing to our professional practices unit. So I believe what you're seeing there from 2014, when we didn't have as many investigators, to 2015, when we increased the staff, we also increased the number of investigations which went before the commission during that year.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
What? I'm going to ask two very simple questions, I think, or one simple question. What year, I was thinking it was 2016, that Dr. Monica Beam came to the agent, to the department. But with that analogy, in 2013, there's 254 investigations considered. I'm just seeing those 3 years as really odd and trying to figure out what was going on.
Right, right. It's thank you for the question, Representative Springer. It's something that I'd be happy to look into further for you. I don't have an answer for you on that one.
What year did Monica come?
Dr. Bean began her tenure in June of 2016.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the issue of dismissals.
Yes.
I'm a bit surprised the dismissal rate is as high as it is, but are there any particular kinds of accusations that are more frequently dismissed than others?
Yes. Vice Chair Wilson, thank you for the question. I don't have numbers in front of me, but from a anecdotal standpoint, I would say TSPC receives a lot of what we call employment issue complaints. Complaints that are best resolved through resolution through the district's official complaint process. The types of complaints that will receive the best results, not only for the student, but for the parent by going through the district. That's not to say that certain employment issues don't eventually elevate to licensure matters, but a lot of the again, a bit anecdotally, but I would say a lot of the dismissals that you're seeing represented on this graphic come from complaints which go through the formal TSPC complaint process, so by law we are required to investigate them, but do not rise to a violation of TSPC rules and would have been better resolved through the district.
Okay. Just one final. Thank you, Madam Chair. At what point in time does the union step forward on a complaint of one of its members?
Vice Chair Wilson, thank you for the question. Every educator has a right to have a union representative or a legal representative present during TSPC investigation, specifically during their interview with our TSPC investigator. So I think that would be the first initial point of where a union would say step into that.
Great, thank you.
Yep.
I don't believe I ever was involved in one. So anyway, they have to give us a call. Okay, any other questions?
One more data point.
Real quickly, because we're
just one more data point. So it asked if you could get us back the information on sex abuse cases as it relates to your chart. Can you also, I mean, I appreciate that there's a privacy issue, but which districts are getting those reports as should be sort of generic information. I would like to be able to see where those, which school districts are turning in those kinds of complaints.
Yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so with that, thank you, Anthony. Okay, with that, I close the informational session. Excuse me. And open up an informational session on the Open Doors Program and Data and Accountability Protocol for High School Reengagement Programs. And so we have Nick, Christopher, and Karina.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Hernandez, and Wilson. Thank you very much, members of the committee. My name is Nick Mathern. I'm the Vice President of Programs with Gateway to College National Network. And I'm here with my colleagues, Peter Wolf and Chris Mazzio. I know that this committee has heard testimony in the past on the topic of high school re-engagement, on the urgency of this topic. We won't be speaking broadly to that topic today, but we'll be speaking specifically to the questions of re-engagement accountability systems, or accountability systems as they would measure re-engagement high schools. And particularly, we will be diving in to the Open Doors system, which is a system in the state of Washington, and talking about its relevance for an application in Oregon. As a refresher on the topic, just quickly, why is a alternative accountability system so important for talking about re-engagement high schools? The reality is that existing accountability measures as they evaluate high schools are not relevant typically for a lot of re-engagement programs. They in fact often punish re-engagement because these are programs that are enrolling students who are often older. For example, in the network of schools that my organization serves, our students come to us 18 years old, but with only half of the credits needed to graduate. So they are, before their first day of school, mathematically out of the running for an on-time graduation. So they're not relevant, and they're also not discerning, because they would essentially evaluate all alternative high schools or re-engagement high schools as underperforming or in need of improvement. They offer us no lens by which to evaluate which schools are high performing and doing well by students and which schools are struggling. So that's something that we feel is important to address when we talk about the issue of high school re-engagement. On all of your desks or on the table in front of you, I provided a copy of a report that you might find useful on this matter. It's called Measuring Success, Accountability for Alternative Education. It was published late last year by our colleagues at the American Youth Policy Forum and Civic Enterprises, and Dr. Mazzio and I had an opportunity to provide editorial feedback on that report. Very briefly, this is a new area, and an area that a lot of school districts and states, frankly, have not waded into. Some school districts and some states have done this, and we'll provide a couple of insights into some of those today. The School District of Philadelphia, Chicago Public Schools, and notably Portland Public Schools have all, I think, really done a great job addressing this topic. Similarly, the state of Washington and the state of Colorado have developed effective alternative accountability programs. But there's still a long way to go. And as I mentioned, my organization supports a network of re-engagement programs. They are college-based re-engagement programs. They are in 20 states around the country. And because so few jurisdictions do address accountability in a way that is meaningful for re-engagement programs, we often need to provide those standards for our programs themselves. So in the case of our network, we provide data analysis for the purposes of continuous improvement. And we also have a staff member of ours who sits on the steering committee of the Open Doors Initiative in the state of Washington. So that provides us a little bit additional insight into that particular system. So now I'll jump right into the Open Doors system. And there's a number of things that were really innovative about the Open Doors legislation, or what it was called was HB 1418 when it was passed in 2010. And I'd be happy to talk to you or your staff on another occasion about all of the different elements of what was so important about the Open Doors system, but today we'll be talking specifically about the fact that Open Doors offers a relevant accountability system for high school programs that are re-engaging students who are previously out of school, students who had either dropped out of school before they received a diploma or who were so far behind in their credit accrual that they wouldn't be able to graduate in their mainstream high school. A couple of kind of big picture elements in terms of what Open Doors does is that first, it removes the risk of further penalty for school districts that will re-enroll a student who previously dropped out. That is to say, if a student dropped out once and you re-enroll them in a re-engagement high school, it does not then penalize you if that student drops out a second time. They are only counted once as dropout. And further, and probably more important for our conversation today, It added indicators of academic progress as a way of measuring schools. Typically, high schools are measured according to a 4-year high school graduation rate in some states, such as Oregon, also a 5-year graduation rate, and then standardized test scores. And those really are the only ways that we're evaluating high schools. And for programs that are serving students who are 18, 19, 20, and 21 years old, those metrics simply aren't always the most relevant. So I'm not going to go into this long list. There's, in fact, 2 slides worth of a list of indicators of academic progress. But my point here is to show you that there are a number of ways in which open doors programs in the state of Washington are being measured. And you'll see on this list, and you can look it up. I provided on the next slide a link to the Washington Administrative Code, the details about what these indicators are. There are high school indicators. There are also post-secondary or college indicators and workforce indicators. So what is really powerful about this is that you're now evaluating the quality of these high school opportunities according to the work that they are actually doing for students and the work that is drawing students back to school. So for students who are perhaps 19 or 20 years old and not inclined to sit in freshman English with 15-year-olds, you're measuring their ability to earn a industry-recognized credential or to earn college credits or to earn a college degree. And so these indicators of academic progress then become a much more relevant way of measuring the efficacy of these programs. So they number A through O in the Washington Administrative Code. So there's, you know, more than a dozen different academic indicators. I'll also note that this is a process that is constantly being looked at. So the Washington Administrative Code, as it deals with open doors, has been revised 6 times since 2010. They have done a great deal of the work for us by blazing this trail, and they're learning a lot. On the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges that they have faced when it comes to collecting data and having an effective accountability system. And I share that these challenges not to kick dirt on them in any way, but because they have been very candid in sharing their experiences with us, so that if we were to want to learn from any of their experiences, we can make sure that not to miss any mistakes that they made, not to make any of the mistakes that they've already made. Initially, when this legislation was passed, it did not come with additional resources, and so the state office there, the OSPI is what they call their Department of Education in Washington, had no additional resources to monitor open doors programs, and they didn't have a mechanism by which to identify students who were enrolled in open doors programs. The state data system in Washington is called CEDARS. That's their student information system. And CEDARS did not have a way to track post-secondary or workforce outcomes. That was not something that their K-12 SIS was built to do. And so they had a number of shortcomings. And for their first several years, they were collecting aggregate data from programs on paper and pencil. As a result of that, they weren't able to really effectively evaluate the efficacy of their programs for their first few years. And they started this work really fresh. They had no baseline for establishing what would be an appropriate benchmark for performance. So there are a number of things that they discovered shortly out as they got out of the gates that were limiting about this, you know, really innovative way of thinking about accountability for high school programs. On the other hand, they simply by doing the work, they did meet a lot of interest, and they have really seen a lot of communities across the state take up this work. There are more than 130 open doors programs now in partnership with over 90 school districts statewide. So despite the fact that there have been some implementation challenges, it has really been something that has been popularly embraced.
Questions at the end.
I can't hear you.
Questions at the end.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, and we're going to have to move along because we've got another one.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. I'll speed this up here.
Did you have a question?
I didn't know if you wanted me to wait till the
real
end.
Quick.
I just had a question in regards to you're talking about the CEDARS system. So with our state longitudinal data system, do you know if that does have the capability of of addressing these?
Dr. Mazzio is going to address that, but I think we'll...
Oh, you're going to?
It will.
That's a nice little short answer.
You want the short? I'll give a short.
Short story, they've made a lot of progress since their initial launch. This will be the first year that they now have 3 years' worth of data so that they can establish some baselines. They built on an additional system that attaches to CDERS. It's called EDS, or their Education Data System, and they use that to collect some of those post-secondary or workforce indicators. It's still a challenge, but they have added some capacity to train implementation staff around the state, and importantly, they still have a long way to go because there are some indicators that they still can't measure. Very briefly, I'll just show you a couple of numbers. You can see that they're serving more than 8,000 students in a year. Their students are coming in over 18 and a half years old. I already mentioned the number of programs and districts partnering. You can see from this slide that over 80% of the students are 18 or over when they enroll in the program. So we're talking about students who certainly need a different type of program. Here are some outcomes from the program. From last year, you can see that they earned many thousands of both high school credits and college credits, nearly 500 high school diplomas, nearly 800 GEDs, 60 college degrees, and 81 industry certificates. I suspect, and I actually feel very confident, that had there been standards or benchmarks in place from GO, these numbers could be much higher today, but they really were building from the ground up. This slide, very briefly, is just designed to indicate that still many of their indicators that students are achieving are high school indicators, but there are a substantial number of college and workforce indicators, and our colleagues who are staff at the department there have indicated they feel that it's actually the college programs and the workforce programs that are being most innovative in addressing the students' competency-based learning needs. Mm-hmm. Finally, for my contribution here, there are three questions that our colleagues from the state of Washington encouraged us to think about if we were to take something like this up. One being, critical that they didn't at the beginning do, but they wish they had. What are the accountability standards for re-engagement programs? And then what mechanism will we use to collect the relevant data and to identify the students and programs who are in those programs? And finally, how will we train those people to make sure that we're using that effectively? So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Christopher.
Okay, and we're done, we'll open it up for questions.
Go ahead and jump three ahead.
Do you want to do questions first, or?
No, that's okay, we'll get through and then we'll have questions.
Great. So Nick has...
And if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Christopher Mazzio, I am with Education Northwest. I'm the Director of Research and Evaluation there. Thank you for the committee for welcoming us today and hearing our remarks. Nick asked me to discuss kind of the issue of accountability and measuring success in alternative education. A lot of what he said kind of has already addressed that. I just wanted to kind of speak to the challenge of how we do that and some of the lessons that have been learned nationally that are reflected in that report and some of the work we've learned in our own region working with Portland and with others in the Northwest. So, calling something alternative education, like a re-engagement program, we're dealing with students that have struggled or disengaged at some point in the educational system. They've either dropped out of school, they've re-enrolled, they face unique situations, and so it kind of demands students have a flexible, more personalized approach. And this is a growing trend, not only in the Northwest and Oregon, but nationally. There are roughly about 2,700 alternative schools, many more programs that serve these kinds of students in very non-traditional ways. And they can be freestanding, they can be part of a traditional school, they can be face-to-face, they can be online, they can use blended forms, they can be a state level, a district level, and so forth. And one of the challenges that Nick underlined in his comments is that these schools are very diverse, but one of the things that's very common is they often perform poorly on traditional measures of school success. So if you look federally, roughly of the schools that are identified as not meeting standards under the federal Every Student Succeeds Act, roughly about 30% of those schools are alternative. And in Oregon, if you look at the data of schools that have been identified as not meeting graduation standards, 24 of the 27 formally recognized alternative schools in Oregon don't meet that basic threshold, which is 67%. So clearly, there's a performance challenge, but clearly this is also complicated by the fact that these schools serve, as we talked about, students that have tremendous academic and social emotional needs. And so an accountability system has to kind of take that into account, and a success system. So When Karina talks, she's going to talk about what Portland has done. Let me just kind of highlight, since we're kind of short of time, some of the kind of ways of thinking about this that leading edge places like Portland and states like Utah and Arkansas, California and others have kind of tried to address. So when we think about success, we always want a student to meet a four-year graduation standard if possible. So you want to have some level of uniformity. When we think of high school education, we think of students are doing well by graduating and they're prepared for the future. We want to balance that with flexibility, and that students come to an alternative education setting with lots of different needs. Some of them are very far away from high school graduation. Some of them are very close. Some of them have high functional skills for learning. Some of them are very low in their basic skills. So you need a system that kind of balances that out and is able to address both the general goal, but also has flexibility built into it, so it can account for those different starting points towards the and vary the amount of time that it takes to get there. So a system in Oregon would have to kind of balance those two out. And then ultimately, when you're talking about an accountability system for alternative education, re-engagement, you want to balance real measures that are very authentic to those that are feasible. So this is the state longitudinal data system, the question raised earlier, can do many of the things that Nick talked about in his comments about measuring success. However, there are other kinds of measures, whether they might be interviews with families or with students, or surveys or others that might be difficult to do at a statewide level, or maybe more expensive or infeasible. So you want to basically identify measures that are readily available and that can be used at a state or a district level through a system like the state longitudinal data system, but are feasible and cost effective. And then the last point is you want to balance the accountability. We want students to meet the end line with how do we learn about how students are going to be able to get there? How do we inform programs, initiatives, efforts to be able to learn? So you want data that actually provides that feedback so these sites, these schools, these programs can get better at what they're doing. And many accountability systems that are designed fail to do this because they provide a one-time measure that gives no information on how do we get better at doing this. And we don't know all the things we need to know about alternative education to be able to say what works automatically. So real quickly, when we're thinking about taking an idea of open doors and bring it to Oregon, one of the things we want to do is we want a system that doesn't identify too many schools. It does no good to have an accountability system where every school is labeled as a failure. The reason that doesn't do any good is it doesn't allow us to focus our attention. Basically, our attention is everywhere. And we need to be able to focus energies on the schools by a rich set of measures that really are challenged. And we need to direct our resources there. So you don't want to identify no one, but you don't want to identify too many. You also, as I said earlier, you want to have an ability to measure success with measures that are available, they're validated, and they're useful for practitioners to improve on the ground. And ultimately, you want, I think, to compare folks to those that are like themselves. So alternative schools are very different. So they're going to most respond when they're compared to their peers, either another alternative school or a school that's serving a particularly specific population. Maybe it's a school that's serving students that re-entered from the juvenile justice system or otherwise. Do you have a question?
I've got to put you on the list. Okay.
So we want to be able to really create a culture of accountability by comparing like schools with like schools. So, and Karina's going to talk about this in her remarks. We think a balanced set of measures that address the ultimate goals of graduation and student success in the future are important, and those encompass a mix of both things that are quantitative in nature and things that are qualitative in nature. So quantitative measures would include a measure of learning. Are students learning something in the program? Whether that's through the traditional tests we might use, whether through something like another form of standardized test, and are they making progress to graduation? Whether they're close or far, during their time at a school in an alternative setting, are they making academic progress? And are they getting more likely to be on track? Are they actually graduating? The good thing, as I mentioned earlier, is most of these kind of academic progress measures are trackable within the emerging state longitudinal data system and will be able to be seen whether a student goes from school to school within a district, goes across districts, as long as the student stays within Oregon, we should be able to identify that. We also believe that a qualitative set of measures, if financially feasible, surveys of students, teachers, and parents can really get at the climate in these schools. And what makes for a successful setting, alternatively, is often deep engagement with the students. So a climate measure is very important to see. Are students feeling like they belong there, they're taken care of, they're protected, they feel like they're making progress towards their future, and so forth. So I will now pass the baton.
Well, why don't we have, we've got three questions. Representative Solomon, Springer, and Evans. Representative Solomon, question? Okay, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it looks like on slide maybe 10 and 11, you showed a graph of, well, on slide 10, I get 12, I guess it is, 481 high school graduates, 787 GED completers. But for that number to have relevance, I need to tie it to the base number. So is that the, going back up to slide 10, is that the students served 8,265?
Representative Springer, thank you for the question. Unfortunately, I'm not able to speak with a lot of precision about what would be an appropriate denominator for that, because the state of Washington, as I understand it, is still kind of developing the ways in which they're reporting their accountability system. They last year reported simply raw outcomes, but didn't report on a completion rate for open doors programs that I'm aware of. I could certainly do some additional research and find out the answer to your question, though, but I don't have it.
Yeah, that's everything, because if it's 481 and 787 out of 10,000 students, I don't know that the program's a glaring success. If it's out of 1,500 students, then we have a different conversation to have there. So I think that's of paramount importance to have that number.
Okay, thank you for getting those information. Okay, Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. I have a question and a comment. As this thing is evolving and you are working through all the qualitative and quantitative measures, the comment or the request or the plea, figure out what you want to test and be consistent with that, because the frustration I've had over the last 15 years with the education system is that some of the tests keep changing, so the data is not useful from one to the next, and it becomes a self-fulfilling educational industrial complex. That doesn't help anybody. The question I have, though, is why is it important to compare to other alternative programs instead of a baseline of folks' completion for GED statewide or potentially social costs avoided? So, for example, the Oregon Youth Challenge, one of their metrics is numbers of incarcerated folks who, from a similar circumstance, are not incarcerated because of that intervention. I don't know whether it's compared to other National Guard challenges across the country or not. I know that that was recognized in Oregon as something that, with the folks who had the biggest challenges against them, that was one of the metrics they wanted to be able to do. So why is it necessary to compare to other programs?
So thank you for the question, Representative. I think one of the reasons it matters is, again, the diversity of these programs and schools are so great. So just think of the amount of learning time in a program where a student might enter in ninth grade versus they come towards the end of their academic career, they're there to just finish a few credits, or they're transitioning right out of another system and are temporarily in a program. So there's such a diversity that to be able to look at the amount of learning time and what the goals are going to be around that, the amount where they're going to get to the next level is important. So because there's such diversity, it's not like comparing a typical comprehensive high school to another typical comprehensive high school. We want to look at sort of the factors that how much time they're in the program, what are the expected learning times, when are they going to graduate quickly, are they going to graduate in a long time, are they making progress, and so forth. So I think that's the reason why you want to compare to their peers. And if you use the four-year graduation metric, or even the five-year graduation metric, we're not going to learn a lot about these schools, because what we're going to see is that all of them basically are not meeting the standard. Right. And that's fine to have that standard, but that doesn't actually help those students be in settings that are going to improve with real meaningful information. So being able to say, of those schools that are all not meeting that standard, which ones are doing a better job getting students towards where they're going to be able to get to the ultimate standards, that we think is a better measure of success. Okay. Does that answer your question?
And you're going to be covering that?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we've got about less than 10 minutes.
Okay. So. Was that the third one, or is there one more? Is that it?
Yes, those are the questions. Thank you.
I head back to. So my name is Karina Wolf, and I am the Senior Director of Multiple Pathways to Graduation at Portland Public Schools. And I have the privilege of serving over our alternative school system and the students and families who benefit from an alternative education path. Part of what I'd like to share is twofold. One is our re-engagement work, which is part of, I believe, this conversation, and as well as our alternative accountability, so shared metrics. So we can, to your point, Representative Evans, really looked from apples to apples or oranges to oranges as far as what we're doing year over year with the same community of students. And so with regard to what we have done is we have done two things. One is, with regard to our alternative accountability metrics, we worked with a number of stakeholders, including ODE at the time, and came out with alternative accountability report card. How do you measure that an alternative school is doing right by the students it's charged to serve, and how do you measure that both for individual students as well as the school as a whole, as well as comparative schools within the same system? So within Portland Public, what we did was we started, and these are the measures that we used. We used academic progress, so either ACOSIS or MAP, credit attainment, and credit attainment. So skill growth in reading and skill growth in math. Maybe you come into school and it's your fourth high school and you have 13 credits, and on paper you say you're a senior. You may not graduate and get 9 credits that year. However, it's still our responsibility for how did we do as an education system. What was your growth in reading? What was your growth in math? And so looking at measuring our students in either both CASAS or MAP from winter to spring, from fall to spring, and then if students graduate or are not there, then we compare fall to winter data, and also looking at credit attainment. As far as successful completion, to the point that was just asked and spoken to, a one-year high school graduation rate. So for students for whom we have who are within 6 credits at the beginning of the year, how are schools doing with those students? So if we look at report cards and we have a variety of students that have, say, they've only earned 12 credits, we're not going to be surprised that they don't necessarily graduate from high school that year because they would have had to attain 12 more credits. But with the students you are given who are within 6 credits of graduation at the beginning of the year or within 3 credits of graduation at the beginning of second semester, for the students that stayed 45 days or more, how did the schools do and how did the students do? So we're looking at specific metrics across our in-district alternative schools and our contracted alternative schools, same metrics. We're looking at the college-ready GED attainment, how are students doing with that performance. We're looking at our post-secondary readiness in the form of the ACT. And we're looking at our data point is overall completion. With regard to school connectedness, part of what we'll look at in the next slide, I'll talk about this, is for students that we re-engage, are we a welcoming environment? Are we giving meeting students where they're at with the variety of whatever their life circumstances are, that they want to come to school and that they're persisting in school? One of the things that we see, and that's a challenge, is that students will come to a particular alternative school and not necessarily persist, not necessarily stick. They won't be in the same school 6 months later. So how are we as schools, how are we as district, and then how are individual school leaders really making and working on school climate issues to look at family engagement and student engagement? So. And we do that with average daily attendance. One of the things that's really important to us is growth in attendance. And one of the conversations I had with a parent actually about a year ago was the principal, I was at a family engagement activity in the evening, and we were looking, having a conversation with a student and his mom, and we were looking at the fact that his attendance was 79%. And the principal had just shared this with me in a meeting that I had had with her. And we shared that with the parent, and the parent was ecstatic. The parent, where we were disappointed, because if you look at chronic attendance, it's below, the parent shared with us, this student loves this school. He comes to school 4 days a week. At his previous school, he went to school about 1 day a week. So we really want to look at how are the metrics different, again, to Dr. Mazzio's point around same schools. And I think it's a good, the question around is literally around, can we have statewide metrics that look similarly? That would be lovely to be able to say how are schools in different regions of the state doing. But what we have right now with our alternative accountability framework is we can at least as a district look school to school, what's a student's growth in attendance, and how can we celebrate that with students and families? And so that's part of our work with growth in attendance. And then our annual retention rate. So for students who ended the year with us and did not graduate, how many are coming back to the same school? How are schools doing holding on to students, right? And then for our GED data point, it's hourly attendance as well. So there's a GED as well as a high school completion data point as well as a high school graduation. And then we are using our district uses a student successful school survey, and we pull out specific questions around safety, around social emotional well-being that we look at specifically for this metric that we have on our report card. So that's our alternative accountability framework that we have worked with, and our first year was in 12-13. So we've got a few years of refining and narrowing, kind of getting hopefully more sage in kind of what we're measuring and how we're measuring.
I hate to do this. We've got 5 minutes, and that includes questions. So
the very next thing, which
so we could wrap it up. Yeah,
I will. Thank you, Chair Doherty. Is that with the reconnection services data, kind of to loop around to the point mm-hmm. of this was the efforts at Portland Public Schools last year. So we have 6 years of data, but this was last year. So of the students who have left school or unenrolled from school, we made contact with more than 1,500 students. We completed intakes with more than 1,000 students, welcoming them back to school. We placed 653 students, and then we look and we say 6 months later, how did we do? Have the students either persisted through graduation or are they continued enrollment? Mm-hmm. So last year's data, from placed to persisted, 73.5 of our students were in this either graduated or had are continued to enroll in the same school 6 months later. Mm-hmm. So one really feeds the other, is how are we both welcoming students back and then finding them a place where they can really flourish, and then how are we measuring and staying attuned to their specific needs and growth metrics that really measure their specific needs, as well as being thoughtful about our alternative schools really doing right by students on a whole. So that's it.
Okay, great. Questions? Representative McLean.
We only have 4 minutes now, and so I'm going to try and make it short. I don't know you guys. I don't know where you come from, or if you're for-profit or not-for-profit, if you're selling a program, or if you just want us to look at, you know, some different information and hope that we engage in it and give it to the Department of Ed to look at or interview or, you know, analyze or something. So I'm not quite sure, you know, where you're at. Mm-hmm. I'm reading this, though. And I think you've got the right population, and you know there's a list of the population here. And I also like the fact that you have some what I would consider to be expansive measurements that are a little bit different than some of the measurements that we've used from people who have not fallen away from our programs or our schools. Mm-hmm. So those are good. But these contracts that you're talking about with the Portland Public Schools, are those for-profit or non-profit contracts? Are they charter schools? What are they?
So I'm not selling anything.
Okay.
I work for a school district, okay. And our goal is to raise the graduation rate. Mm-hmm. And so that's my investment in looking at how we do that as a state and as a system. So that's the outcome that we're after here. With regard to We have in-district alternative schools at Portland Public Schools. Alliance High School and Metropolitan Learning Center are in-district alternative high schools, or schools. And then we have contracted with nonprofit organizations who by statute are private alternative schools whose mission is to serve this population, and we follow alternative education statute in doing so.
And how many of them are online?
Zero. We have zero online.
And then so you have a contract and you're contracting for a specific service, and the services are the same or different?
The services are to provide high school for alternative students needing alternative placement.
Okay. Because what this was, this we've worked with PCC on this and so on. This was the this is the third hearing we've had on reengagement program.
Yeah, reengagement. I get. Yeah. I just don't know open door.
Yeah, this is all based on the reengagement program that we were working with the Senate on, and so on and so forth. And
I just want to say, Representative Solomon and I have just gotten done working on an effective and safety, committee, mm-hmm. and we had one whole area that was on reengagement and transitioning, mm-hmm. transitioning from school to school, transitioning grades, transitioning mm-hmm. from incarcerated youth, which you also have in your list. And so I'm just curious about your program, especially because it is a public school program, and just on if the contracts are for similar skills, but you're saying they're there to provide alternatives of ways to graduate, either GED or a five-year program or a different type of program.
Okay. So it's students who need alternative school, so alternative school statute, so we follow the OARs mm-hmm. around alternative ed.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because Tiger's got a similar program where they have a reengagement specialist that goes out and does what you do.
And Open Doors, with regard to your question mm-hmm. about Open Doors, I think Open Doors was the path forward that Washington took mm-hmm. to say, how do we do a better job as a state around the students that we are losing and who are impacting a lower graduation rate than we wish for our state. Mm-hmm. So that's really where we're looking at.
And very quickly, because I have one question also.
Thank you, Chair Doherty. I applaud your work on that, because I know that it is very hesitant sometimes for school districts to re-engage those students because of that dropout rate and being able to come back. It was when I was a school board member in Hillsborough, I did go on a trip to the San Juan Far School District in Texas. And Texas really did a lot of work to look at how they could re-engage mm-hmm. their students and bringing students back, and they raised their ADMW to like 25, I think it was, mm-hmm. To bring students back. So I applaud this information. I thank you for that, and I'll look forward to reading this deeper.
And I have one question. When it comes to kids dropping out and leaving and not graduating in 4 years, what is the factor that we've got 44 states that have lower requirements than we do? Credits. We've got 24 credits, and like Washington State's got 19. Some states have 15, 13, 14. Does that make a difference with our graduation rate that we've got 9 credits more than a lot of other nine credits more required than a lot of other states?
It's a very good question. Possibly. We don't know for a fact that mm-hmm. that is a factor. We actually, as part of our regional education lab, are in the process of studying. Washington just instituted a new policy mm-hmm. to increase the number of admission requirements. So we may be able to learn from them and what that does in terms of their graduation trajectory. But we don't know for a fact.
Because you don't know how many kids have 19 credits when they see you, but they don't have 24.
And I will just say one of the things, and I know we're short on time, but one of the things that I think also impacts is how we categorize students in alternative mm-hmm. education. So if you look at California, for instance, if you look at other states who do use charter schools as the data set, or they have kids in alternative, like California has a designation where students, instead of being in an alternative school, they're in a charter school, and then they are not necessarily always in the district data, but they go to the state data set. Mm-hmm. So there's different ways in different states that complicate that impact how Oregon looks.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your presentation. Okay. With that, I close the informational hearing and open up an informational session on funding for school lunches. Colt and Heidi. Watch that guy. He's trouble.
He is. Gentleman.
He's a gentleman. Because not only himself, he's also retired military. That's a double gentleman.
Good combo. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, good afternoon, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. I appreciate being here this afternoon. I have brought my ODE's Child Nutrition Program Manager, Heidi Dupuy, to help with certain parts of this presentation and definitely to help with answering some of your questions. I'm going to jump right into it and talk about the school lunch program, specifically related to 2015's House Bill 2545, which required districts to provide lunch at no charge to students who were eligible for reduced price lunch. So in that year, the legislature created a state school fund to carve out to reimburse districts the 40 cents that's not covered by the federal funding for no charge students, so students eligible for reduced price lunch could then be afforded that same opportunity. The program in the 2015-17 biennium saw $105,000 shortfall. So it's one of the things that we want to address with you, some of the reasons around that and maybe possible solutions as well. This slide shows the sort of history. So 2015-17 biennium, we saw the amount allocated to this fund at just below $2.4 million, but ODE received reimbursement claims totaling just over $2.5 million. So that's where we came up with the shortfall of $105,249.
And if you didn't introduce yourself, if you introduce yourself for the record, sir, we know who you are.
I introduced Heidi, but I failed to introduce myself. So I'm Colt Gill, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction at ODE. So then running down to the fourth bullet there, the amount allocated for the current biennia is a little bit over $2.4 million. We do estimate a shortfall at the end of this biennia right now of about $181,000. So we've taken a pretty close look at this, and we're tying the shortfall to three factors right now. So one is that there's been an economic upturn in our state, which has caused students that were previously eligible for free lunch to now be eligible for reduced price lunch, which means we have more students in that program designed House Bill 2545 program. We also have participation in school lunch programs increased as a result of 2545, which means the program's working. And we have some school districts who have opted out of the federal community eligibility provision, CEP program, causing state expenses to increase. And we'll talk about a little bit about what the CEP is in just a minute.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, there are fewer free kids and we're picking up more reduced lunch kids.
Right.
We're paying for that.
Yes. Okay. And then more students in
the
program.
So that's the good news and the bad news.
Very much. Yes. Yep. Yep. And I'll hit on that economic upturn right here. So this economic upturn in our state has moved families who were qualified for free lunch, like Chair Doherty said, to the reduced price lunch category. The federal National School Lunch Program reimburses the full amount for lunches served to free lunch eligible students, but under 2545, the state reimburses districts for the 40 cents previously paid to families who were in the reduced price lunch program. So this improved household incomes moves families from free to reduced price, lowering the federal reimbursement and increasing the state reimbursements of those 40 cents per lunch. Make sense? We also had increased participation overall. So House Bill 2545 encouraged more families to certify for free and reduced price lunches. And then previously eligible families had to cover the cost of the reduced price lunch. And this was a barrier even at that level for some families. So when 2545 was implemented, more families recognized, oh, now I'm at a full free lunch level, so I'm going to enter the program. House Bill 2545 allowed families to participate at no cost to their household. So in that sense, again, good news, the bill worked. Mm-hmm. The community eligibility provision. So this is a provision where schools and districts have opted out of recently for a variety of reasons, and some of those are in the second bullet related to changes in school boundaries, grade configurations, economic improvements in the area. Could be participation in the program became less economically advantageous to the district than participation in the standard plan. And this, as the state has studied it, happens more often in the larger districts and less often in the smaller districts. So we have.
And you're going to explain what CEP is.
Yes, we'll explain what that is. And the larger districts have been opting out to some degree, and smaller districts coming in. So again, we're seeing another place where we have more students on the House Bill 2545 plan. So now I am going to pass it to Heidi, and so she can do a few slides with you around exactly what the CEP program is.
So Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Wilson and Hernandez in committee, I'm Heidi Dupuy, the manager of the school nutrition programs. So we're going to move into the CEP or community eligibility. And this is a federal program that allows districts, schools, and groups of schools to provide breakfast, lunch to all students at no charge based on the student population eligibility. So we're not looking at what households, the income of households, we're looking at the whole population that school has. So the federal eligibility provision has some criteria for schools to participate. And the first one is that they need to have an identified student percentage of at least 40%. And we'll get into the details of that shortly. They also need to be participating in both breakfast and lunch so that students have access to both breakfast and lunch at school. And they need to agree that they will not charge for breakfast and lunch for any student, whether they are their household has income or not. The identified student percentage comes from the count of students that are receiving benefits from SNAP, TANF, food distribution on Indian reservations, or educational services as migrant, homeless, runaway, foster. Households do not fill out a traditional eligibility form. So we're taking the eligibility that those students have in these programs and applying it to the National School Lunch and School Breakfast Program. The identified student percentage determines the eligibility for CEP and also is the basis for claiming percentage. How we calculate the ISP is we take the number of identified students from those different services and divide them by the total enrolled students as of April 1, multiply it by 100, and we have the identified student percentage.
And that's like the 40%? I mean, if it's like...
40% is the floor for participating.
So if it's 35%, you're out of luck. 40%, yes.
Okay. So see, the child community eligibility provision has two reimbursement rates, free, which is the highest federal meal reimbursement, and the paid rate, which is the lowest. The ISP is multiplied by 1.6 to determine the percent of meals claimed at the free rate. That 1.6 is determined by USDA, and it represents that for every child that's participating in one of those programs, there are six others that would have applied on a paper application. Schools with an ISP of 62.5 or higher qualify for free reimbursement for all the meals that are served. And so that's the standard that schools want to reach, is that 62.5% ISP. So for schools in choosing whether to be on community eligibility provision or stay with the standard county and claiming, they really are looking at what's economically beneficial for them. And for schools, especially for schools that are between 40 and below the 62.5%, they, if they have a ISP that is less, would give them a free percentage that's less than what the participation is under standard counting and claiming, it will be better for them to stay on the standard program. And now with House Bill 2445, the reduced price students still get their meals at no cost to the household as if they were a CEP program. Participating schools can leave CEP at any time if they find that the reimbursements are not meeting their expectations. They also have the opportunity every April to assess their ISP, and if it goes up, they can move to a higher claiming percentage and start the four-year cycle over again. And then they can seek other funds. We have had legislation previously proposed to help fill the gap between their reimbursement rate for CEP and their standard.
Yeah, because I understand there were quite a few, with redistricting, especially in Portland, there were quite a few elementary schools that lost the CEP, where everyone used to get lunch and breakfast, and now it was different.
For the on the federal program, when schools are grouped, you're able to use the percentages of all of the schools in the group. And so if you have a school that has an ISP that's greater than 62.5, that means they can't get reimbursed for greater than 100%. Mm-hmm. So you're able to shift those excess percentage points to schools that are lower and have more schools participate at a higher reimbursement rate. But when you're in a group, if a school district changes anything about those schools, the school closes, the boundaries change, the grade grouping is different, you have to start all over. And we've been in a series of improving economics within the state, and so there's less students receiving SNAP benefits, which is the lion's share of the percentage. So an example that we have that illustrates the previous slides is in David Douglas. They also had five schools move from CEP to standard counting and claiming because all five schools were in a group and one school left. And when they did that, 279 students were added to the state's reduced price eligible population. Those students who had been exposed to the National School Lunch and School Breakfast Program maintained their participation rate from CEP back into standard at 67.4%. They're in a standard program, that percentage rate would be around 59%. So they're eating more lunches. And that added 31,216 lunches for state reimbursement with a cost to the state of $12,486.
Now, does the school district have to contribute at all?
Or? No. So that is the end of my presentation.
Okay.
Questions?
Yeah, any questions? Representative Solman.
Thank you. Chair Doherty, I have a couple questions in regards to, I've been meeting with some school districts locally and talking about the lunch program and some of the issues that they're looking at financially. And some of them have noted that their free and reduced lunch have taken a as you're saying, a down, they've turned. Now you've posted one reason for that. And I'm wondering if also, are we able, because it is a federal program and that students and families fill out paperwork, I'm wondering if, are we able to supply our families, reassure them that these documents are held confidential? I mean, how is that shared? Because I think that could be a direct concern mm-hmm. for families, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious about that. And the other issues I think I can take offline to save time, too. But.
Okay. So, Chair Doherty and Representative Solman, so when the applications are presented to the household, they have a companion parent letter that outlines whether they'd be eligible or not. And one of the statements in that letter is letting them know that any information that is supplied on the application is only used for meal benefits and will not be used for immigration.
So that's done on paper?
Oh, that's done on paper, yeah.
Okay.
Chair Doherty, may I also add? So, and the confidentiality goes beyond immigration service. So it is confidentiality within the district as well. So there are only certain employees that are allowed to know which students are receiving free or reduced price meals. Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, one of the reasons we did this is school nutrition is such an important aspect, and we wanted kind of an update on when we did pass the picking up the reduced lunch and what the impact was. And so it is one of those good news, bad news. You know, the good news is the economy is better, and the bad news is it just means that more kids move from free to reduced. Therefore, it was an additional aspect. And so hopefully we'll be able to fill this gap, because right now it's split amongst the, in fact, if you want to explain, the $105,000 is split amongst
how
many?
Yes, absolutely. Chair Doherty, so that shortfall does get split across all school districts based on their participation. Mm-hmm. So the $105,000 is split across 197 districts, and that's just dollars that they aren't being reimbursed.
Right.
So that's a proportionate share for each of the districts. There are some possible solutions to this we can look at in the future. We can look at different kinds of funding streams. We can look at different allocation levels. There is an example in place right now where our breakfast program actually has a surplus. Our breakfast program is funded through the general fund to ODE's budget. The House Bill 2545 is a state school fund carve out. We aren't allowed to intermix those dollars, so we can't use the surplus in the breakfast fund to pay for this $105,000 shortfall in the other fund. So that's another possible solution that we could look at, is a way to stipulate in cases of surplus funding in for these particular purposes that funds could be diverted within the agency to meet the statutory provisions.
Yeah. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I saw this on the agenda, quite frankly, and should have looked a little closer, I was hoping that you would be touching on the House bill we passed in 2017, lunch shaming.
Lunch shaming.
And I've heard from several school districts saying that their numbers have skyrocketed as far as the money they're struggling to collect. And hoping to get a feel for what's going on there.
Because actually that is what was we're going to have on the September agenda, dealing with the shaming and the issue of, and one of the things is some school districts don't think that they can send bills to the parents, and they definitely can. And so this was an issue that we brought up, that we wanted to make sure that we brought up at the September meeting, because there just needs more information for school districts as to, yes, you can send a bill in the mail or in the email for what the parents owe.
Okay.
So
can I ask a question?
Without going to the child at all.
May I follow up on that? So I've heard that's part of it. The other is there's just not a mechanism to collect. I'm not saying there should or there shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. But I also know from past experience, I've attempted to pay another kid's bill. They wouldn't let me. I think that's just kind of dumb.
Well, I've seen some school districts that they've picked up the whole thing.
Yeah, I stood there and the kid didn't have the money, and I said, take it from my son's account, I'll pay the bill, whatever.
Okay.
And they wouldn't do it. So I'd love to also have a school district in here talking about how they're doing it, because I do think they're missing some opportunities. Yeah. I think the money's up.
Yeah, that's
but
why
I think they're missing opportunities.
And that's why we wanted to make sure it was on the September agenda.
Well, if we're going to talk about it, then fine. But this is maybe one more piece of information. Forest Grove, for example, went from $1,000 to $40,000 plus.
Mm-hmm.
And they send out an email and they send bills both.
Yeah, and so that's why we wanted more that's why we wanted more time to go through and discuss this and get information before September.
Okay.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. I don't know what their current balance is, but in another lifetime, we instituted an auto dial call when I was running the lunch program in Westland. So some districts do that, and I get the call, your child, Tucker, has a low lunch balance, or your child, Tucker, owes money, is usually what it is. Mm-hmm. And that's been very effective because it doesn't then go to the child. It comes to us. Mm-hmm. And so the technology director in the Westland Wilsonville School District, he might be somebody worth bringing in to talk about some of the automated things that they have done. The Jennifer who works in my office used to work in our lunch office with me. And, you know, we also sort of hand-dialed and called parents when it got too out of control. But we were really able to manage that, just by kind of with automated technology. And that was 12 years ago. Yeah. So it's out there, and there's some school districts, I think, doing innovative things to help ratchet that
right. Risk. I think there's some things, and that's why we wanted to give them some time to go through and do it, to deal with it in September. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you so very much. That closes the informational session on school funding. And I just wanted to make an announcement about the Open Doors program. Karina from the Portland Public Schools provided the handout. And I just wanted to let people know the report on alternative high school accountability is now on OLIS. It was not on OLIS before, and now it is. Okay?
Great.
With that, I adjourn.